WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Today on Fresh Air, Terry Gross talked with Matt Zapatowski of The Washington Post about the role Attorney General William Barr has played in how the Trump administration handled the protests, its use of force against peaceful protesters, and how the Justice Department has been responding to charges of police brutality and killing in cases like George Floyd's. Tune in at 2 on 93.9 FM or ask your smart speaker to play WNYC. This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart, and you just heard our interview about the life and death of Sandra Bland. And she and Breonna Taylor are probably the only women you can actually name who've been affected by police brutality. So why are black women and black trans women often left out of this conversation? Black women's erasure from police brutality protests can be linked all the way back to violence against women during slavery and violence against black girls during schooling. Here to discuss this with us is Andrea Ritchie, researcher, advocate, and author of Invisible No More, Police Violence Against Black Women and Women of Color. Andrea, thank you for making time today.
Thanks so much for having me.
So there are many high-profile police brutality incidents involving women, Breonna Taylor, Tanisha Anderson, who in 2014 died while suffering a mental break while in police custody. Deborah Danner was 66 years old when she was shot to death by an officer in her home who perceived her as a threat. These weren't filmed. How much of a role do you think video footage plays in black women's cases being overlooked?
I think it plays some role. I do think that there is a significant portion of police violence against black women and girls and trans folks that happens in private, that happens in the context of calls for help, for whether it's a domestic violence call, a sexual violence call, a homophobic violence call, or a call related to unmet mental health needs. But I don't think that's the end of the story by any stretch of the imagination. I think it also has to do with how we conceive of police violence and what images come to mind when we call up that issue or that question. And they are images of black men who are assumed to not be transgender, like Tony McDade, who was recently killed by police in Tallahassee. They're assumed to not be gay. It's either a beating or a shooting. And I think that there are plenty of those that take place in public view, on camera, of black women. I've seen countless videos just over the last 2 weeks of black women being shot in the forehead with rubber bullets and still in the ICU recovering, of 9-year-old black girls being pepper sprayed in the eyes at protests, of black women being pushed over, shoved down, beaten, attacked by police. I think part of the problem is that even when we see it on camera, we don't recognize it as police violence because it doesn't line up with the story that we've been told about what police violence looks like. And it doesn't line up with the story we've been told about what gender-based violence looks like, which is domestic violence in the home against a white woman. And so it leaves black women experiencing police violence in the street, in their homes, in community institutions, in social services offices like Jasmine Headley, who are not being folded into the main story of police violence, even though you just named way more than the two women that you named at the top of the hour. And I'm currently staring at a poster of 100 black women and girls killed by police, which is not all of them. It's just the ones that we could think of when we made the poster.
In your book, Invisible No More, you trace police brutality against black women back to slavery and Jim Crow era. What were some of the forms of violence specific to black women during slavery? And how do they relate to
systemic
today?
Certainly, systemic sexual violence was inherent to the institution of chattel slavery in the United States, particularly after the transatlantic slave trade was closed. It was the means of reproducing a population of enslaved labor in the United States. And so systemic sexual violence by law enforcement is still the second most frequently complained about form of police violence in this country, but it's not the second most frequently talked about. So there's definitely a through line of state sanctioned and state sexual violence from slavery to the present, and also in the middle, sort of document or concurrently documented by Ida B. Wells, of sexual violence in the context of lynching of black women, which is another form of violence. So we talk about Ahmaud Arbery and people being lynched as similarly being exclusively black cisgender men, and black women have a long history of being lynched in the United States, and as recently as Renisha McBride being killed by someone when she knocked on the door seeking help after having had a car accident. So there's the physical violence, there's the sexual violence, there's violence against pregnant people that happened during slavery and that I document in the present day. And actually a woman was beaten by an officer during a protest recently and lost her pregnancy as a result. Mm-hmm. And then there have been several other pregnant people who have been harmed by police in the context of these protests. So that's another through line. I think policing of black motherhood in the context of slavery, both demonizing black mothers, punishing them, and also separating them from their children, and then justifying that by saying that black mothers are not good mothers, is something that continues to this day, both by police and by the child welfare system. And you saw, for instance, in the arrest of Kalima Rosier in the subway for allegedly not wearing a mask properly, she was taken out of the subway and her child was left behind with police officers. Mm. The child was eventually reunited with his father, but that's not always the case. Often a police encounter will result in a separation from your child, as it did, for instance, in Jasmine Headley's case, where she was on Rikers for 3 days and her child was in Child Protective Services all over where she was sitting in a social services office. So these through lines continue, and some of them, as I said, are very similar to what we see with men, their beatings, their torture, their killings. Some of them are gender specific, their rape, their sexual violence, there's policing of pregnancy and parenthood. And then finally, there's this sort of pathologization of black women's sexuality that was used to justify systemic rape during slavery, and then immediately at the end of slavery was used to regain control over black women's bodies and reproduction. So as soon as black women were no longer enslaved, they were immediately being arrested and re-enslaved through convict leasing for prostitution-related offenses and theft-related offenses. So your presence outside as a black woman was seen as evidence that you're engaged in prostitution-related offenses, and if you were working for an employer and you ate some of the employer's food, you would be charged with theft. And those are still two of the top charges that black women are profiled for and charged for by police. And you saw two black women beaten outside of Chicago by police officers brutally on camera on the perception that they were there to loot at a store when they in fact were going with family members to get supplies, as so many of us are doing in this pandemic. So there's so many ways that historic perceptions of black women and the ways in which those perceptions are projected and policed continue to this day. It's just such a clear through line. And what I want to say, and that wasn't apparent sort of in the film, which, you know, I very much appreciated and salute Sandra Bland's family for making and sharing with all of us, was the widespread activism and organizing that has happened around black women's experiences of state violence also since that time, also since slavery, also since Ida B. Wells talking about lynching and state violence, and since the civil rights movement. I think a lot of people don't know that Rosa Parks, before being a central organizer in the Montgomery bus boycott, was a member of the committee in defense of Gertrude Perkins, who was a black woman who was raped by two Montgomery police officers and then framed up as someone who was engaged in the sex trade and therefore somehow deserved this. And so there's a long history of black women organizing around sexual violence against protesters during the civil rights movement, for instance. Many organizations, National Council of Negro Women, Delta Sigma Theta Sorority, organizing around that issue, and that not being part of the story of the civil rights movement. And so I do worry a little bit in this moment that we continue to say that no one is organizing around black women's experiences of policing, when in fact black women have been, are, and continue to be, and black trans people continue to be organizing around, for instance, the case of Toni McDade. The question is whether that organizing is also being invisibilized and why.
Well, exactly. It's that people aren't paying attention to it, not that it's not necessarily happening.
Exactly.
Let me, before we run out of time, I do want to talk about one thing I think is really important that you talk about in your book, that you link police violence against black women to the policing of school-age girls and policing in the schools. Do you think that the defund the police movement will reckon with this? Would this be
absolutely
an important move forward?
Absolutely. It's already happening in Minneapolis, where the school board severed its ties with police. It happened in Portland, and people are demanding that it happen in Chicago, and people are demanding that it happen here in New York, led by groups like Girls for Gender Equity and Black, which is a Black girl-led organization. And so I think that the primary place to start this fight is about taking police out of schools and saying we can find better ways to resolve conflict, harm, and need when we're talking about children. And we can definitely find better ways that don't involve violence against Black girls, like we saw in the famous video from Spring Valley High. Or, again, a hidden form of police violence against girls in schools is that it's one of the primary sites of police sexual violence and harassment. And so if we want to end not only violence in schools, but also defund police and invest in things that are actually going to help us thrive and build true community safety, schools are definitely a place to start. And I hope that this administration in New York City considers that in this budget cycle as part of the $1 billion cut in police budget and investment in things like community education that broad-based coalitions are demanding.
How do you feel about the Say Her Name, hashtag Say Her Name movement? Is it useful?
I think it continues to be useful. I think it's always been useful. I think part of it is even, you know, when I was on a march one of these nights, and I've been on many, where I did continue to hear, you know, George Floyd's name said. I did see signs for Breonna. I did see signs for Tony McDade. But the chance, I really did feel like in that moment, just like as that hashtag came from the marches around Eric Garner, where we also wanted to say the names of Michelle Cousseau, who was killed 3 days after Mike Brown. We wanted to say the name of Chantel Davis, who was killed right here in Brooklyn. We wanted to say the name of Valerie Carey and other Black women from Brooklyn as we were marching for justice for Eric Garner, too. And so similarly, now we still want to say Breonna Taylor's name when we're talking about this issue, not just for visibility, but because it will inform our action. It will help us understand that the war on drugs is what killed Breonna Taylor, and that's something we need to attend to because that is a primary site of both physical, sexual, and deadly violence against Black women and girls. So if we want to prevent what happened to Breonna Taylor from ever happening again, we need to look at the root causes, and we need to look at the other places where police violence happens against Black women and girls, and that tells us we need to defund responses to violence that harm Black women and girls and don't protect them, and we need to resource non-police responses that actually create safety for us. And so there's so much to learn beyond saying a name. We need to say a name and take action that is consistent with honoring that person's legacy, with honoring Sandra Bland's legacy, with honoring Breonna Taylor's legacy by taking action, as Geneva Reed-Veal orders us to, that will prevent that from ever happening again.
In our last minute, what is one thing someone could do? Has heard this segment. They want to do something. They want to do something
call
on this
council,
issue.
Call their council member and tell them to support a $1 billion cut to the NYPD so that we can invest it in the things that Black women and girls and trans people need to stay safe in New York City, including safe from police violence.
The name of her book is Police Brutality Against Black... No, excuse me, Invisible No More, Police Violence Against Black Women and Women of Color. Andrew J. Ritchie, thank you so much for joining us and sharing your writing and research. We really appreciate it.
So grateful to you for having me.
This is all of it on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Join us back here tomorrow. In the meantime, be safe, wear a mask, be safe, wear a mask.
WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics Pre-Alcohol Probiotic Drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at zbiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's zbiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.